CliffCentral.com.
And dance.
Yeah, walk the moon and shut up and dance. Beautiful. All right, it is CliffCentral.com on a Monday morning. Leslie Smales joined a cult, and her story is pretty terrifying. Take a listen to this. Leslie Smales is the author of a book called Cult Sister, and she tells the story of how she was taken into a cult. She was basically removed and isolated from all the things that she'd grown up with here in South Africa, and found herself in a very, very scary situation. It's the kind of story that you'd almost think was the screenplay for a movie, but it actually happened. And it must be a terrifying place to find yourself, because you go in hoping for and believing in the best. And I suppose there are lots of people who, you know, they join organizations, clubs, churches, perhaps, you know, sororities or fraternities and all kinds of other things that make them feel like they belong somewhere. And for many people, that's an important thing to have in your life. It gives you a sense of meaning and purpose, and you feel community with other people. But it can very, very quickly go bad if the people who are running the whole thing have nefarious purposes. And I think that's the story in a very broad nutshell. But the details of it are worth exploring, and I'm so happy to have Leslie here with us this morning. And you look like you emerged unscathed. You don't look at all damaged by this. Well done to you. I mean, psychologically, are you okay?
Oh, that's debatable.
No, we were chatting before, and Leslie was just saying to me that, you know, I had a friend who was kind of one of those people who just everybody loved. He was gregarious and friendly and fun to be around. And he married this girl, and he's just completely isolated himself from all of us. And we were friends for years, 15, 20 years, and he's just disappeared off the radar. Completely. And you said to me, well, that's what they do. That's what these cults do.
Yeah, I think that is their modus operandi, to separate and deconstruct all your previous beliefs and core systems.
So what happened to you? You finished matric, and then you decided you wanted to explore the world.
Yeah, I was. I didn't even want to go to America. I really just wanted to go to Europe. My friends that were going to be joining me in Europe still had to save some money, and I had a friend in America that I was at boarding school with, so my mum suggested, why don't I go and visit her while my other two friends were making bucks.
And you were originally from PE?
Yeah.
So you leave PE, you think, I'm going to go on this adventure. Did you have any sort of gaps in your life that you needed filled at that point? Were you someone who was looking for a spiritual awakening? Were you someone who was looking for community, or were you just going to go and have fun?
Well, I didn't really know what I was going to go and do. I actually was completely oblivious as to what was awaiting me in the States. I was naive. I wasn't all that innocent, but I was naive, and I was quite damaged from a lot of drama and trauma that had happened in my adolescent years, family stuff, and just life in general had taken its toll. And I was quite a rebellious adolescent, and I loved to...
Oh, well, can we go through some smoking?
Cigarettes, weed, yeah. Whatever. Okay. I could get my hands on. Tick. No, there was no tick back in the day.
But I mean, you'd meddled with all that stuff.
Yeah, I'd taken acid, I'd smoked mandrax, I'd drank autumn harvest, crackling. I was a teenager.
And I mean, were you regarded as being one of the badly behaved rebel girls, or were you kind of like all the other girls?
No, I was considered a bad rebel girl.
Oh, really?
I was expelled from boarding school for being the rotten apple of the bunch.
Wow.
I was promiscuous. I embraced Jimi Hendrix's Have You Been Experienced idea, and I just went forth to go and experience as much as I possibly could.
So when you left, your mother said something that was a warning, but it was also prophetic.
Yeah, she said, don't get married, my darling, don't get married and don't join a cult. Those were her parting words. At the time, the Moonies were quite rife in America, and there'd been a lot of publicity about the Moonies, and I think it was a fear of hers that I was just going to
Just remind us, because a lot of us aren't necessarily old enough or smart enough to have read about the Moonies. So just remind us who they were, because it was quite a big movement in America.
Yeah, there was a guy called Sun Yat Moon, and he seemed to be into arranging mass marriages.
Yeah,
I just remember a little photograph in like the Scope or something of just hundreds of people
married en masse.
Yeah, it was quite bizarre.
Mm. I mean, I remember, before we get into the specifics of how you ended up in this, but I remember, you know, those Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas.
Yeah, that had also just happened.
During the Clinton era. So there was quite a lot of bizarre stuff going on.
Yeah.
There were people who had started little groups here and there. But when you went over there, who did you – you went to see this friend of yours. How did you get introduced into this strange world that you had no idea about?
I initially went over to stay with family friends of ours, and they bought me a Greyhound 30-day bus pass so I could see a bit of the States.
Hmm.
And I don't think they realized quite what I was going to go and experience.
So what happened? Did you get on this bus and decide, let's see where we can go and let's see some of the tourist attractions?
Yeah, I went in a little boat called Maid of the Mist under the Niagara Falls. I kind of plotted a journey all the way across America and then back again. I wasn't quite sure exactly where I was going.
Did you have any money?
I had very little money. I did have some money. They gave me spending money. I didn't have copious amounts of cash, but
sure.
I had enough for the journey, for a 30-day journey.
And was it a time and a place for a young woman to be on her own and without any necessary connection to other? I mean, we didn't have cell phones in those days. You were almost going out entirely alone.
I was, not almost. I did go out entirely alone. It was...
I mean, that's brave, right?
It was very brave.
all of 18 years old.
My granny used to say, "Domin leerlikus niks maar stupid." I think it's a foolish thing to go off all by yourself that young.
If anybody asked you for that advice now, you'd say to them, "Don't do it. You're mad."
Yeah.
So what happened?
I went on this Greyhound bus journey. I experienced a lot of stuff. I remember landing up in Denver, and there was some Seventh-day Adventist family friend that I was supposed to stay with. I never met them, and it was a pastor and his wife, and when I called her up, she said, "No, we don't have any place for you." And there I was in Denver all by myself in the middle of the night, nowhere to go, no contacts. I had a lot of awkward situations like that. I ended up staying at a guy's house that I had asked directions to the YMCA or the YWCA, and he said, "No, he took me to it and it was closed." Then he was like, "Come home and stay with me."
Oh, yeah.
Awkward situations I got myself into. I told him that I was a lesbian to try to stop him from climbing into bed with me.
Wow. And living from your backpack, basically.
And living from my backpack, yeah.
God, what an incredible thing. I mean, in some ways, it's up to this point, it's an interesting story and a happy story. It doesn't necessarily have to go horribly awry. But when did you come into contact with these people from this cult?
It was only once I had gone to the West Coast and then back to the East Coast. I was in New York City and in Washington Square in Greenwich Village that I actually met one of the brothers. I found him quite attractive. He looked like one of Jesus's disciples.
Mm-hmm.
He had a long shirt on and handmade sandals and a bushy beard, and he was Jewish, mm-hmm. and he really fitted the part.
Wow. And were you just taken in by him because of his appearance and his general demeanor, or was he also a very charming person, interesting to talk to? What was the hook?
I spoke to him briefly, and then I left him, but just from that brief contact, I got filled with quite an immense joy, like an overwhelming joy, and I just felt like I had to go back and see him again. So I went and cancelled my appointment with the guy that I was traveling with for a supper date, and I went back to the park to see if I could find the man again. And that was where I met my would-be husband.
Mm.
I didn't find him charming. He was quite austere. He told me that the way that I was dressed was wrong, that my hair...
Straight away.
He just, like, started laying out the law.
Wow. Did you feel any kind of anxiety around that? I mean, to be told all of that stuff upon your... This was your first meeting with him.
Yeah.
Your future husband. I mean, to be told those things, you'd think someone would just, like, the opposite ends of... like, the same ends of a magnet, you'd just be repelled.
Yeah, it was strange. I just right after writing my first, well, actually typing my first matric exam, it was a typing exam. I had met a young guy who invited me to church, and I had gone to church with him and given my life to the Lord. And so, meeting this man that told me that the way I was dressed was wrong, and that, you know, my lifestyle was wrong, and he used scripture. It really cut me, and cut me to the quick of my core.
But do you think that had to do with a guilt? Do you think it had to do with a fear of doing things wrong, or were you just alone and this was a person who'd taken an interest in you?
Well, he hadn't really taken an interest in me. I had taken an interest in him more. I was just really desiring to be right with God. I had been so damaged, and I was so smudged by various experiences I had been involved in, that the concept of being made clean and becoming pure was very appealing to me, and that this man used the scriptures to point out certain issues in my life really struck a chord in me.
So was he a Christian for all intents and purposes?
Yeah.
That was his preferred kind of way of describing his religion.
Well, he said that he was a believer. He said that he was a disciple of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that he used the word disciple because he looked the part.
Mm-hmm.
He was intriguing.
So would you say you were almost in love at first sight?
No, definitely not.
No? But you were intrigued?
I was intrigued.
And how did it develop from there?
Well, he said to me that it wasn't even right for him talking to me, that I should meet one of his sisters.
Wow.
And that intrigued me more.
So that she would almost be like a filter?
Yeah, he said that there was a very high standard in amongst the group that he was with, the church that he was with, and that one of the standards was that men wouldn't really talk to women, that I should better be talking to his sister. So I arranged to meet her the next day.
And what was she like?
She was amazing.
Yeah?
I think I might have fallen in love with her at first sight.
Fun, friendly,
she wasn't
warm.
Fun. I wouldn't call her fun initially, although she was a lot of fun. We had great fun together. She was strikingly beautiful, although if you took her apart feature for feature, she wasn't that beautiful. But with the spirit inside of her and the grace that seemed to be around and in her, she was just extremely beautiful to me. She was quiet and dignified and, very beautiful.
And what did she say to you? And what did you two talk about? Did you say, oh, I'm quite keen on your brother, or your brother instructed me to meet with you? I mean, how do you even begin a conversation like that? It must have been very awkward.
I said nothing about being keen about her brother. She said, I can't remember what she said. She invited me back to their house for a meal. And... yeah, I don't remember much of the conversation.
So what were these guys called?
They didn't really give themselves a name. They called themselves the brothers and the sisters. They referred to themselves as the church, sometimes the brethren. Many people gave them different names.
Uh-huh. Were they organized into some kind of bigger body? Was there an authority? Was there a church? Was there a place everybody got together?
You know, in the scriptures it says that all that believed were together, and they sold their houses and possessions and lands, and no man said that anything was his own. This group that I joined with, they fashioned themselves according to the early church that's described in the book of Acts.
Mm-hmm.
There's a scripture about being pilgrims and strangers on this earth. They took that literally. We were like I joined myself to a strange body of people, not a massive amount of people. There was probably never more than 100 of us, but we were a church. There was a leader. His name was Jim Roberts. You can look him up on the internet. There's a lot of information about him. A lot of it's derogatory. He was a very dignified gentleman. He was quite a mystical character.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of controlled everything that went on in the group.
You ended up marrying this guy.
Yeah.
And you spent a period of what, 10 years there?
Yeah.
And during all that time, you were communicating with your mom back home. Because obviously, you know, your parents didn't just go, okay, bye-bye, we'll never see you again. They were writing you letters. And you kind of painted this picture for her of this really lovely, happy, pleasant, pastoral existence, when in fact things were not as rosy as that.
That's correct.
She had no suspicion.
I don't know if she had no suspicion, but I did try to keep her out of the raw difficulties that I had exposed myself to.
What were those broad difficulties? What were the time? When was the moment that you realized that maybe this was not the most healthy place to be?
The moment that I realized that was when I was happily skipping along a street in Brooklyn, New York, in front of this man that I just married, and he reprimanded me and told me that I must walk behind him, that it was not right for me to be in front of him. And for me, that was just like, oh my word, what have I done?
Yeah.
He went against everything that my dad had taught me a gentleman was.
And clearly a controlling, authoritarian sort of bent on everything.
Yeah, I don't think he meant to be like that. I think he was afraid of what the older brothers would think, and I think that had a huge impact on how he handled and treated me. He just wanted to be in right standing with the older brothers, and he had to keep his house. I was his house.
In order. How difficult was it from that moment on to convince yourself you hadn't made the worst mistake? I mean, you stayed for 10 years. There must have been lots of things that you thought were good about this. You must have believed very strongly that you were doing the right thing spiritually. But there must have been lots of other warning signs that this was not a good place for you to be.
Yeah, you know, I was very, I had youthful arrogance. I was, once I'd done what I'd done, I couldn't go back and say I'd made a mistake because I was so proud.
Yeah.
I'd married into the group. It wasn't an easy thing just to free myself. I think my pride.
How did you have to dress? What did you have to do every day? Did you have a job? How did it work?
Yeah, right when I got to the church, they told me that I remember I had a cotton gray onesie on, and I was told, here's a skirt for you to wear. Sisters shouldn't be dressed like this. It's not becoming for a woman to be wearing pants.
Mm-hmm.
And I was given a maroon skirt to wear, and yeah, things slowly, I slowly started to realize that I was entering into a new kind of life, and I was willing to embrace it.
Did you lose a bit of yourself, though, in all of this?
I think I lost a lot of myself, but I was quite happy to lose a lot of myself.
It sounds to me, when you talk about it now, that you still feel these people meant well.
Yeah, they did.
And you still feel like you were party to this voluntarily. There was never a moment where you were kind of acting out of a lack of agency. It's like you wanted to be in this and you wanted to make a good life for yourself in this world of these brothers and sisters.
That's correct.
And even now, you don't feel that these people were necessarily bad or that they'd done horrible things?
I think that their intention was coming from a pure place.
Controlling other people?
You know, the scriptures talk about being subject to those that are in authority. It talks about that you must let everything be done decently and in order. It talks about elders in the church. There's a definite hierarchy in the Bible it talks about bishops and deacons and elders and pastors and preachers and teachers and evangelists and that. So there is the scriptures do talk about authority and being subject to authorities.
And so you didn't have a problem with that. You don't still have a problem with it.
No, I do have a problem with it because most people in a place of authority end up, not most people, but many people in a place of authority end up abusing their authority just because they are human. And we all are human. We all make mistakes and we all can abuse power if it's given to us.
What was the most difficult thing about being in this cult, in this brotherhood and sisterhood? What was the most complicated thing for you personally? What did you hate the most about it?
I hated it that I was so cut off from my family and friends. Although I submitted to it, especially being cut off from my family, I didn't like that. I didn't like it that I didn't have a free choice. Like if I met someone that I wanted to bring back to the house that I felt needed a place to stay or something that I had to ask. I couldn't just ask them of my own free will. I had to ask a brother, and then I was usually told no. I hated not having my own free will. I was quite rebellious.
In the
group, we were told that sisters weren't supposed to speak about things, but the sisters came and started confiding in me, I think because I was quite an open-minded person.
Were you ever punished for your transgressions?
I think towards the end, there was a kind of a punishment when we were in danger of losing our children. It wasn't a punishment, but we weren't really given a place to stay, and I found that...
threatening.
It was very threatening.
Now, how about the kids? I mean, you had children with this man.
Yeah.
In this community.
Yeah.
Was that expected of you? Did you have any kind of right to object to the idea that you might not want to have children at that time with him, or was it something that was expected?
I don't think we were expected to have children, but if children came along, they came along, you know. We weren't to use contraceptives. So I did later on in my time in the church, I did come across a book on natural birth control written by a woman called Iname Gaskin. I'd studied her book called Spiritual Midwifery, which actually has a Buddhist slant. I kind of kept it secret. I had all my children at home, so I wanted to know what I was up against having my children at home. So I studied this book, Spiritual Midwifery, and then I went on to get Iname Gaskin's book on natural birth control.
Because otherwise, what, you would have just carried on having children?
I started to resent not being able to be in more control of my life and what happened.
How many children did you eventually end up having?
I ended up having three living children. If all the children that I conceived were alive today, I would have 9 children.
Wow. And the others?
I miscarried quadruplets over a period of 2 months, one by one. And my youngest son was a twin. I miscarried his twin. And my first baby I conceived when I was in matric was aborted.
That kind of been easy without having your own family around and being in this community. You must have felt very isolated and alone at many times, especially when you're in this kind of pain, because these are not easy things to go through for anyone.
I was very blessed to have my mom and my gran come to visit. And my gran came just after my eldest son was born. My mom came at my daughter's birth, and she was there just after my youngest son was born.
So, what did they think of the whole setup there? Did they think it was strange?
Yeah, I think they thought it was very strange.
And you convinced them that you were okay and you were happy?
I try to.
Yeah. Now, the hardest part of this, the most difficult, apart from obviously these very complex situations where you lost children, but the hardest part of this is breaking away from these people and rebuilding your life almost from scratch. I mean, how does that feel? How did you come to that realization? How did you get yourself free?
Like I said,
and I don't mean to make you cry, I'm sorry.
I cry so easily. It wasn't difficult to leave because we were kind of forced out of the group. My husband was a very controversial character, and he...
How so?
He came against a lot of the doctrine that was preached in the church. He questioned authority. He questioned... he thought that we should keep the Sabbath, and he came up against the elder of the church with doctrinal disagreements, and the elder of the church didn't like this, and so we were kind of ostracized. Mm. Like I said, there was a threat of losing my children, and the elder didn't provide a place for us to go to, and so we had to seek outside help. We went and family friends, and yeah, you'd have to read the story, buy the book and read the story to find out all the... how we left. And
good sales pitch. But did you both come back here?
We both came back with all the children, looking like a fifth-rate circus.
Well, it must have been very strange to come back. It must have been very odd for him, first of all. He hadn't been to South Africa before, right?
Yeah, I think it was way more difficult for him. He had got an Afrikaans Bible when we had first got married, and he had studied, made it his job to study Afrikaans, and so it gave him a place to practice his Afrikaans, but he really struggled to fit in to society. He had been with the group since he was 17,
yeah.
And he was socially awkward. He was still very entrenched in the group and group mentality. And yeah, it was very difficult for him. It was much easier for me to slip back in. And
but Leslie, it must have also struck you that now that you were outside of the clutches of the cult itself, that you two could start again. You could abandon some of these principles that had not worked for you, that you could give up on the authority that had been forced upon you, that you guys could start your life again. It seems almost like you wanted to continue some parts of it.
He wanted to continue. He didn't want to start life over again. He wanted to continue in what we had been involved in. I think he had a grandiose idea of setting up a church similar to the church in the States here in South Africa. I quickly started to slide back into old habits and old things that I'd been involved with, people that I'd known. It was much easier for me to adjust than it was for him.
And did you raise your kids under these strict principles?
When we came back to South Africa, I'd been homeschooling my eldest son. He was 7 at the time. He was way advanced for his age. When we put him into school, we found a school that was a Christian school that children could progress at their own rate. So they put him into Standard 1, and he was doing his reading with the Standard 5s and coming top of the class. He had been reading since he was 2.
Hmm.
He was great. I mean, I remember taking him to a Shakespeare play in the park, and there were a lot of matric students there, and they weren't getting the jokes. And my son Ruben was like, "Look behind you! Look behind you!" And he was like laughing in all the right places. And yeah, he was a brilliant person.
So it seems that there was a bit of in inverted commas, normalization going on.
Yeah. I quite quickly normalized, if that's the right word to use. Although it also took me years to just to change, yeah, slowly.
But it does feel like there's a lot of pain back there.
Yeah.
And the way you describe it, it's your children gave you a whole lot of joy and happiness and a feeling of accomplishment, as they should. But that you probably weren't as happy as you could have been.
Yeah, happiness is a strange thing.
Do you think it's the natural setting for us? Do you think we should be happy most of the time, or do you think that that's a rare and special thing?
I think definitely that we should be happy. I think we are made, we function best when we're happy. I think that it is something that God really wants us to be, is to be happy.
You're still a very spiritual person. You're still a Christian.
Yeah.
You still believe in Scripture.
Yeah.
Don't you feel that a lot of that stuff is what caused your misery?
Yes and no. I think a lot of what caused my misery is when I, you know, I embraced hedonism for quite a few years, and I have been a big party animal in my life. And
but that was when you were much younger.
No.
Recently. Yeah. Well, good for you. You went back to it, huh? Turned on the taps. What kind of hedonism, though? Are we talking about complete abandonment of responsibilities?
No. I'm a very responsible person. I am a mother, yeah. And I've been the breadwinner in the family, and I am very responsible. But the pursuit of pleasure versus happiness, I pursued pleasure.
And do you feel guilty about that?
Not anymore.
What did your husband think of that?
Yes, he was not charmed.
Because he must have felt you were slipping away, that you were becoming a derelict person.
Derelict, that's what a word.
I mean, don't you think? I mean, I would imagine from his point of view, you were abandoning your morals, you were stepping outside of the embrace of God and all the important things.
I think I grieved him terribly.
What was his response?
That's a difficult thing to answer because, it was very traumatic. He thought that I was going mad. It's a whole nother book.
And the children?
My children are amazing. They're well adjusted. I kind of grew up with them. I left their dad. When they were adolescent, I realized that if I didn't put a distance between us and him, that I was going to lose my kids. He was a very strict disciplinarian, and he didn't like the way that his whole family was turning out, I think.
Did he eventually go back to America?
Yeah, I used to pray, please, Lord, remove him. I didn't want him to die, but just to remove him. And thank God, God removed him all the way back to America.
You have any communication with him to this day?
No.
No, completely cut out. And the children?
My children are in contact with him, but on a very regular basis. He did go over to see two of my children last year where they were living overseas. Mm-hmm. Which was a great thing. I'm very glad about that. I lost my eldest son, Reuben, in 2014, and Thomas and I had communication during that period of time, and he expressed a desire to get back with me, and he said that if I didn't want to, would I please not write to him again, because it would be too hurtful, and so I stopped writing to him.
And that was the end of your communication?
And that was our last communication.
What happened to Reuben?
Reuben died in 2014. The autopsy said cause of death unknown, so it's still a bit of a mystery to me.
How bizarre. Where was he when he died?
He was in Thailand.
How strange. You that can't be easy to just accept.
you know, Gareth, something that has been such a great consolation to me and has cemented my faith again and rooted me back into the Word and is revolves all around Reuben's death. I spent a month with him in Thailand 2 weeks before he died. When I came back to Port Elizabeth about a week and a half later, I said to my mum, I've got a really worried feeling about Reuben in my gut. I'm a very intuitive person. And I just had and also being a mother, you know, you have mummy intuitions, and I had a real disturbed feeling in my gut, and I said to my mum, I'm so worried about Reuben, I don't know what's going on. And she said, come, my darling, let's pray and fast for him this Sabbath. And so that Saturday, I'd never fasted in my life before, but I spent the day in prayer and fasting. And actually on that day of praying and fasting, the Lord said to me in that little still small voice that we can tune into, the Lord said to me, Leslie, why have you written this book and nobody's reading it? Put it out there. So I put a chapter of my book called I Sat Down in the Fallen Leaves and Wept about finding a can opener when I really needed a can opener. I put it out on Facebook, and that evening the Lord impressed upon me again, why have you written this book and nobody's reading it? And so I put my first chapter, or part of my first chapter, onto Facebook, and the next morning I woke up and I was so excited. How did my friends take my, you know, my first chapter? And that was when I found all the phone calls and the messages to say that my son had died on the day that my mum and I were praying and fasting for him.
Oh.
So I have a consolation and a peace that the two women that loved him the most were upholding him in prayer.
Thinking of him on that day. It's a very difficult life to contemplate looking back now. I mean, you say you're in, you know, you've come back to your spirituality, you've kind of re-embraced your faith and all of that stuff. Do you have any regrets about the time that you spent in America, about what happened since? I mean, you even got to say that you got to not say goodbye, but you got to spend time with Reuben before he died. But there must be some holes. There must be some spaces that you think you could have filled better.
You know, during my pursuit of pleasure while my children were adolescents, I think I put my own desires and needs first, and I try to live without regret. If I could go back and change anything, I think I might change that. I don't regret joining the church or traveling with the church or having my children. I would do it all over again just to have my amazing children and all the wealth of experience that I have and the amazing stories and testimonies of how the Lord provided for me and looked after me. And yeah, I've got an amazing amplitude of wonderful testimonies. And yeah, these are my treasures.
Well done on the book. I think this should be the kind of thing that anyone reads. I mean, would you suggest to anyone that is going traveling that they should be aware and careful of these cults, that they should stay in contact, that they should remember who they are in all of this? Because somehow, I mean, you got in some ways the best of both worlds. You got to see how it works. You got to be a part of it. It fulfilled you in some ways, but you also managed to get out before it took all of your individuality.
Yeah, I would definitely warn people to be careful, to try the spirits, that not everyone that says that they are of God are of God. I would really encourage parents to buy my book for their children that are leaving matric. I don't think it's a book that young people should read, because, you know, because I do write about a lot of issues that I wouldn't want my friends' young children to read my story yet. But once they reach 17, 18 years of age, I'd say definitely give the book to them to read, because there's a lot of warning in it. There's also a lot of truth. but just to realize how easily and quickly you can become submerged in a way of life that might not be to your advantage, I would definitely say buy the book and read it.
I hope it does very well. I hope you continue to do very well. And thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
Thank you for having me.
It's Symphony featuring Zara Larson on the vocals. Clean Bandit. CliffCentral.com. And a 3-day week. It's Monday. It's almost 8:40. So Auto Trader and Auto Central are on in just a short while from now. I thought it'd be fun to talk to the guys quickly. And Tyron's in the studio. George is on the line. Because there's something quite exciting happening. I mean, it's always hard to say goodbye to certain things, but it's also part of evolving and getting better. And we've got copies of the first ever Auto Trader magazine, the print publication, cost 50 cents in the day. And it's incredible. I'm looking at it now. 50 cents, your used car journal, first edition, how to buy and sell a secondhand car, finance advice for the buyer, and then the next edition out on April the 30th. So it was weekly.
Sure.
Unbelievable, huh? And look at this. If you look through the prices of cars here, you can see there's a Nissan... There's a Nissan for 23,000 Rand. There's a Toyota Corolla. Those are great. 1.6 GLS 1988 Oyster Grey. Had a radio tape, mags, 62,000 kilometers for 26,950 Rand.
You can literally go through this all day. Because like some of these old Mercs are still 27,000 Rand if you get a really good one. But like back in the day, that was the sort of opening price.
That was first hand, yeah.
I'm pretty sure I can find John T. Searle from the Sex Show's Merc in here. He's got one of those old, what was it, E190s?
Yeah.
I practically grew up in a Toyota Cressida because that was the car that I had from my childhood. I mean, look at this. The 2-liter GS 5-speed, 48,000 Rand.
Yeah.
what is that, my buddy?
I just can't believe. I cannot believe how far we've come.
Well, here we are in 2017, and it is now time for us to say goodbye to the print edition of Auto Trader. And from Auto Trader, we've got Tyron here, and we've got George on the line. Hey, George, how's it, Tyron? How are you guys?
Hi, Gareth. Good, and you?
How's good. Awesome, you, awesome. George, where are you?
I'm in Cape Town, as a matter of fact. I've just landed at the airport, and I'll send you a picture, but I'm standing in a public telephone booth talking on my mobile phone.
Wow.
Hello, digital.
Yeah. Isn't Hello, it nice, digital, though? Yeah. I mean, it's quite – in some ways, it's sad to say goodbye to some things, as I said earlier, but it's quite exciting to just be able to throw the print away and to go straight to digital. You guys have been kind of doing both for a very long time. What eventually made the decision for you – Or how did you eventually make the decision to end the print publication of Auto Trader?
Well, to tell you the truth, I didn't make the decision. The consumer made the decision. We waited for a very long time to see how long the magazine was going to hold out with the consumer. And we were a very different market to any of the other international markets.
Yeah.
Print took a good part of 9 years to actually decline. And in January this year, we realized that both the consumer demand for the magazine as well as the advertising appetite by the car seller had declined to a point where it was cost prohibitive to print.
What do you think is lost and how much is gained from this? Because there are some people who like the feel of a magazine, and I know that they're few and far between now, but there are a lot of people who might have felt there was something more legit to seeing it in print. Do you think there's still some people like that, or do you think everybody's kind of wised up to the fact that if it isn't online, it doesn't matter?
I think if you're over 50, you're probably still in that camp a little bit. I think the thing that's lost is the attention that you would have had in browsing through the magazine. Whereas now, as you know, on your mobile phone or on your tablet, you browse through cars, and next minute there's a notification, and you go off on a rabbit warren, and you're in some other world. So I think the attention span has been lost with digital, but what's been gained is in that magazine we could print about 1,000 pages at a maximum, and we could publish about 8,000 to 10,000 cars in those 1,000 pages. Today we've got 67,000 cars online, so the consumer has gained a world of transparency and volume.
Yeah, Tyron, what's it like to see this very old first ever Auto Trader from 1992?
I think it's fantastic. It just shows you, what I love about it is looking at the car prices in the back of the magazine. Yeah. And just while we're talking about the old publication, Gareth, we have got 8 activations happening across the country today. So if anyone's keen on picking up a copy of our first edition ever, they can get them at the various activation points around Johannesburg. And if you do want to find out where those are, we have got a website about the campaign called autotraderhellodigital.co.za. But for me, just looking at how car prices have changed over the last couple of years, it's ludicrous, actually. You know, if you look at some of the car prices, yeah, brand new cars. I mean, if I look at the most expensive BMW back in the day was only 574, you know, odd thousand rand.
And that was the 850i.
850i, yeah.
That was a sexy car in its time.
It still is a sexy car.
Yeah.
Ben found a nice car here just now. What is it?
Do you remember the Ford Sierra? You had one of those. You definitely had a full dance card, huh? The Sierra XR8. There's one here, 300 kilowatts, leather sunroof, radio tape, central locking, new turbo, very fast, like new. 39,950.
Very fast.
Trades considered.
I saw a Cadillac. It was a Cadillac for sale for like 23,000. And it says, call Ben anytime. I didn't know you were selling Cadillacs
back in the day.
Wow.
As an 11-year-old.
So are these, did you have archives of all of these, George? Did you guys go and dig this out of a cabinet somewhere and dust it off and then make copies?
No, not quite. We've got some originals, but what we did was, because we still had the electronic versions of the magazine, we sent that to the printer and asked them to print the very first magazine again for us. So it's on today's paper, but it is the first magazine's content.
That's pretty amazing. There are even articles in here. Listen to this. This is a radio article. It says, as a result, hang on, I'm going to do this properly because otherwise people won't believe me.
As a result of the pressure and bumper-to-bumper and gear-grinding nature of PWV traffic.
Do you know what PWV is?
Mm-mm. No.
Pretoria Witwatersrand Vereniging.
Oh, God.
Before it was called Gauteng, guys, 1992.
A radio tape deck has become vital in making the driving experience less traumatic. As radios have become more sophisticated, so have the tastes of the people who buy them.
Ooh.
The only thing that hasn't changed is the fact that the inexpensive radio tape deck is still the most popular.
How things have changed.
Yeah, I mean, here we are. We're doing an Auto Central show, which is on the internet, which comes through people's mobile phones. In 1992, if you'd said that to them, they would have said, you're a raving lunatic. There's no way.
Yeah, you absolutely are mad.
So it shows you how much innovation and development has happened since 1992. George, what did it cost you to print these things back in the day, and how much did it cost you to print them up to a couple of days ago?
Well, it depended largely on the size of the magazine. But if I tell you that at the time when the magazine was at its thickest, which was about 600 odd pages on average. We had a lot bigger magazines sometimes, but on average it was about 600 pages. Cost us around 70 million rand a year to print that magazine.
And you had to have high quality photographs in there. You had to have lots and lots of info. It must have been, what an expensive business.
Absolutely expensive business. Jesus. But in today's day and age, that sort of cost now goes into things like marketing, being on Auto Central. So the cost base doesn't go away. It just changes its nature.
It must be exciting also to see that people are comfortable on the internet. You know, I remember a time when people said, for example, oh, no, I wouldn't, I certainly wouldn't spend money online. I wouldn't give them my credit card details. These days, almost every major transaction involves people doing all their searching and most of their buying online. Is that what you guys have found too?
It's unbelievable. Yes, it's absolutely unbelievable. I mean, all of our private ads now come via our online ads platform. And, you know, we still phone every single customer, but in the future, that's not going to happen anymore. And right now, you put your credit card on AutoTrader's site, you trust it, you believe that nobody's going to steal your money. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case.
And what kind of traffic are we seeing on autotrader.co.za? I mean, is it thousands and thousands of people every day?
Well, I mean, you talk about print versus digital. In the magazine's heyday, we sold about 110,000 magazines a month.
Wow.
Today, we sit with just over 2 million users visiting the site per month. So we're more than 20 times bigger from an audience point of view than we were back in the print days.
That's amazing. What's the cheapest car you guys have ever sold?
Jeez, I don't know. Probably in that magazine that you're holding.
Yeah.
And have you ever sold anything really, really ridiculously expensive that you can recall?
Well, I'll tell you the funniest ad we've had. Somebody tried to sell a secondhand space shuttle. In the magazine. This was in the early 2000s. Somebody had a secondhand space shuttle.
You're joking.
They didn't sell the bloody thing. No.
That's phenomenal.
Secondhand space shuttle.
Wow.
So we've had some weird and wonderful things. We've had the donkey ad go around a couple of times. I don't know if you've seen the donkey ad. And we've had a couple of funny things over the years in print.
I love this. It says here, right in the beginning, first 4 seconds, and it says the Auto Trader is unique to South Africa's secondhand car market. And you know that there was a spelling error in the word second.
There was no C. Sion. Yeah. In car market. Wow.
No other publication provides you with a photograph of the vehicle for sale so that you, the buyer, can see the car that you would like to purchase. Beyond this unique ability, we strive to produce a professional, friendly customer service and a reputation as being reliable and effective in the tough secondhand car market. We can help you, the Auto Trader.
Lovely, hey?
Huh? How's
that? There was no autocorrect in those days, and every single word had to be proofread by a human being, and hence the spelling mistake.
But isn't it great that, I mean, you guys, in that time, there was no other publication that had a photograph of the car that you wanted to buy.
Correct. And we were the only company that sent an agent to your house to take a photograph of your car.
Wow. Someone would pitch up with like a Kodak camera. Yeah. And then
4 hours to set it up so you can take a picture of the car. Yeah.
You'd have to drive the car outside, park it in a nicer spot.
Wash it,
make sure there's decent lighting. That's great. Jeez.
Believe it or not, Gareth, we actually used to use floppy disks to store the images of the car back in the day when digital cameras first hit the market. And we brought the floppy disks back to the office. We stuck a floppy disk into an old antiquated computer. We did the DTP publishing and sent the PDFs off to the printer to print.
See, that's incredible. I'm blown away. I'm kind of sad in some way that the magazine is finished. I remember looking through it when I was at Varsity and I had to get my first car and I was trying to find something that I could afford. And I remember looking through the old original Auto Trader and here you are some years later and now you're saying goodbye finally to the print publication. So all over the country there are these activations going on.
Activations all over the country, Gareth. Yeah, we're running a couple of competitions. We've got an awesome campaign happening. If people, you know, want to engage, they can log on to autotrader.co.za. We have got a banner on our homepage which will lead you directly to our campaign site. And it really is that simple. And really what we want listeners to do is tell us what they think should be left in the 90s. There's a lot of stuff that should be left in the 90s, you know, and that's what it's about. So, you know, we're leaving our magazines behind, and tell us what you think.
George, what else should we leave in the 90s?
Public telephones.
Yeah.
I'm just walking past this thing up and down, talking to you, and I've been standing here for about 30 minutes, and not one person has come near one of these things.
No, there's no point to them anymore. Do they still have them in London, those red ones?
they used to have telephones in. I'm sure they don't.
I think only for photographs nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, you'd use it for Instagram.
Yeah.
That's the only use for it. Yeah. But there's lots of stuff. I can think of plenty of things from the 90s that we should just be very pleased we're rid of. If you can share what you think would be best left in the 90s, you can go onto Facebook and Twitter using @AutoTradersSA, and you can use hashtag BuyBuyPrint and hashtag HelloDigital.
That's right.
As the two hashtags for those. And you can win one of 10 500 Rand cash prizes.
Yep.
All right, George, have fun in Cape Town, man. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks, guys. Thanks,
all right,
guys.
Awesome. There we go. George Meany in Cape Town with Auto Trader's last ever publication of the print Auto Trader magazine today. Huh? What's going on? What's happening here? You think sugar? Hang on. Rummy's just...
another day in our lives.
Rummy's shouting and screaming at the window. What's going on, baby? Go to this microphone. Right here.
What is...
No, no, here. Yeah, no, talk to us.
Wait,
talk to us.
Yeah.
What's up? What's wrong?
We don't have brown sugar. I don't take white sugar.
Okay.
I mean, how white do you want
to be? Is that what you're going crazy about out there? I find you...
This is our life.
Listen.
I want brown sugar, Gareth.
You know what? Brown sugar should be left in the 90s as well.
Yeah, I agree.
No, no.
Look at her. She's losing it over...
Because I don't eat white sugar.
Let me tell you something. You are lucky Jane is not here because she would have been ranting and raving and screaming back at you. But we'll sort out the sugar for you later.
Fantastic.
All right. Joe,
thank
Rummy.
You.
Having a heart attack out here because of sugar.
Genuinely upset.
This place is always mad. All right. Well, Tyron, listen, all the best, man.
Thanks very much. We'll
catch up with you on Auto Central a little bit later on today.
Fantastic.
That's at 10 o'clock.
That's
and
right.
Don't forget, if you can, to make it to some of the activations that are happening all over the country with Auto Trader.
Yeah, just jump onto autotrader.co.za and you'll see all the relevant details.
Pick up one of these. Mubs, give me a car from the 90s that you remember that you thought, wow, if I could have that car. Any car.
One day when I'm big.
Sure, guys. I was only like... 10 in my 90s. I wasn't really looking at cars like that.
Come on, Mavs. Didn't you want a Honda Ballard?
Oh.
upwards of 47,000 Rand.
Ooh, I remember that. My neighbor had that. And had these like suede covers on the seats.
A Honda Ballard.
Ooh.
I remember my dad had a Jetta CLI exec 16 valve. And it was the beast of beast cars. Here it is. 83,000 Rand.
That's amazing. That's a Volkswagen Jetta.
16 valve. No, you either got a V8 or a V10 or a V12. Otherwise, shut up. No, 16 valves. That was me.
Shucks.
There are lots of Buckies. Uh-huh.
Lots of Buckies.
Yeah. Isuzu diesel Buckies for 50,000 Rand. That was in 1992. What would you pay for one of those now? Any idea?
For
a new Isuzu diesel Bucky.
Jeez, like, yeah, upwards of 300,000, 400,000 easy.
Unbelievable.
Crazy. Anyway, nice to flip through the old magazine though. Yeah, hey, kind of like brings back some memories. Exactly. Yeah.
This is really, it's very nostalgic. I love it. And it's even, you've even used like paper from, it feels like this paper is ancient.
Yeah, well, we try to use newsprint from, you know, so that people could really get an understanding of what, it looks like it's been lying on the back of someone's kind of.
Or like a lounge in a Rosettenville.
Yeah, exactly. With the sun beams through the window.
Are you kidding? This is still the best publication that most households have
in
Rosettenville. It's the only thing that the kids can read. All right. Thank you very much, Tyron. Auto Central brought to you by Auto Trader today on cliffcentral.com at 10 o'clock and the end of an era as the Auto Trader publication gets put to bed. Rums, what's happening in your show this morning? You want to give me a quick snapshot of what you guys are going to be doing between 9 and 10?
Yes, I know what we're doing today.
Tell me.
Today we've got Ponzo.
Mm-hmm.
Ponzo, she's an amazing woman. She's an author. She's an entrepreneur. She's a motivational speaker. She's a...
one over the weekend, this time beating the Waratahs. After the match, they were seen talking to the Waratahs players and swapping jerseys. Many thought it was a great sign of sportsmanship, but they were actually just asking if they could play for their team next year in the tournament, because the Kings, of course, won't be in it. All right, we'll see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. CliffCentral.com.